You are listening to Zen and the Art of Triathlon.
Well, hey there, all you triathlon and endurance studs and studettes. And welcome to another great episode of Zen and the Art of Triathlon, the podcast where we go long on endurance and learn a lot about ourselves along the way. Well, okay, we've got a very special show today, something I'm very excited about. We have pro cyclist Chase Wark with us for an interview over Zoom. And Chase is one of the best and most interesting cyclists in North America right now. Not only does he win or podium at some of the biggest races, it was just announced in the news right before we interviewed that he got picked up to be in the Lifetime Grand Prix for 2024. And that is a series of 7 off-road endurance races, which includes Leadville, Sea Otter, Unbound, basically the biggest races in North America, for a total prize of $300,000 for everybody put together, but $30,000 for first place, and it works its way down to $7,000 for 10th. And it has become such a phenomenon that they even are on season 2, I believe, on a YouTube series, a TV show, about the people that get selected to be in this race and their life over the year. So what makes Chase so interesting is that he's really smart about implementing the marginal gains that add up to making all of us faster. He takes stuff that we are already doing in triathlon and applies it to gravel, where there is tons of things people are doing that is slow. And how this happened is gravel hasn't been competitive until very recently, not to the level that we've seen. So it still has a healthy culture of people just out for a joyride and wearing loose fitting clothes and purposefully, you know, not trying to go fast, and the whole lead group stopping at an aid station as an agreement and the race not really getting serious until the very, very end. And it's also a lot like an Ironman or an ultra marathon, where these things are really hard and it's just an accomplishment to finish. So everybody's acting kind of like age groupers up until recently. So once things took off with being truly competitive, it's considered almost counterculture to try to do things to make your bike faster or make your kit faster. It's not the spirit of gravel. But for those of us in the know, what people like Chase Wark and Dylan Johnson's another famous person that's doing this stuff are doing is just low-hanging fruit. It's easy things that can make you much faster. And like triathlon, a lot of off-road racing is not UCI sanctioned or enforced. So there's a lot of interpretation of the rules of what you can do, which we found in triathlon leads to a lot of innovation that ends up trickling down to the other sports and ends up having a huge impact on the cycling industry. Now, triathlon was using aero bars, and then in 1986, Greg LeMond used a set of triathlon aero bars in the Tour de France and won by the margin of seconds that the aero bars gave him. And then 2 years later, I'm at the local bike shop buying a Schwinn Latour as my first road bike because of the impact that Greg LeMond had, and that really exploded cycling in North America. And where gravel and mountain biking is learning a lot of aerodynamics from triathlon, they're turning around and paying it back with learning a lot about rolling resistance and how much faster you can go with lower tire pressures and wider tires, and that's affecting all the bikes on the road, including your road bike, now averaging like 30 millimeter tires or 32 sometimes. And same thing with triathlon bikes, with us learning that as long as the rim matches the width of the tire, you can go a whole lot wider and still be really, really aero. And then you have more comfort and less rolling resistance, and you go faster in the end. So we talk a lot about that. We talk about aerodynamics. If you can Google Chase Wark and look for the bike with the disc wheel on the back of it, it's mostly a disc. It's a 180 depth wheel. It's a head wheel. And he rode that at Gravel Worlds last summer and got second place. And when we just did Valley of Tears together a few weeks ago. He got second place there. Oh, and by the way, he wins a lot of races too, like Rock Cobbler. And the bike he rode at Valley of Tears had that same wheel on it. And he and the best cyclist, considered the best cyclist in off-road racing in North America right now, Keegan Swenson, traded punches the whole race before Keegan finally took the win at the end. So we talk about Valley of Tears. We talk about aerodynamics, tire rolling resistance, Chase's history, where he came from, where he's going. We even talk about which hydration pack to wear, which one's more aerodynamic, Camelback or Yusui, which is the big brand that's taking off-road racing by storm. And it turns out it's not what you think. And we totally agree with each other. It's pretty great. That's a great moment in the interview. But the interview is an hour and a half long, so I actually split it into two because I didn't want the entire show to be just interview. So we get the first half of the interview today, and then I follow it up with some swimming training log. I try to do three big swims in a row. That has an effect. And also today, I went for a 4-hour bike ride, and also previously made some other videos on other bike rides that you definitely need to check out at Instagram. I'm Zen Triathlon, and we've got us feeding a donkey with carrots, which is really, really funny. Kai's girlfriend got a new bike, a Cervelo Espero, which has just got this most beautiful paint job you've ever seen. Oh, and I show some TPU inner tubes that I got with removable valve cores so you can put sealant in them, and also save a couple turtles out of the road. You know, the typical stuff that makes Instagram a lot of fun. Oh, and some news. After the interview, I do a little bit of endurance news, like talking about Jasmine Paris, who became the first woman to finish the Barkley Marathons. And then also, some big news here, I'm trying to expand the name of the show to be Zen and the Art of Endurance, because since the beginning of this, we have always covered other things besides just triathlon. And I think, you know, running ultra marathons, swimming across Lake Tahoe, all this gravel racing lately, marathon mountain biking, it all falls under being an endurance athlete. And one thing that I talk about on occasion is I believe in training like a triathlete with plenty of swimming, biking, and running all the time. And then you can compete in any sport. Sign up for a trail run race, do a triathlon, and then do a gravel bike race, maybe swim the mile at a local swim meet, and then go spend a nice Saturday afternoon mountain biking at the local mountain bike park. You could do all that within just a month or two by using triathlon training as your base. So no worries about me or where triathlon is going. Like I told my wife, I can't give up triathlon. It's the only adult sport that combines long distance swimming with anything else. And swimming's the only sport where I actually get to feel really fast. I actually got started in triathlon because I was swimming to stay in shape for surfing. And the local triathlon team saw me swim and they said, hey, you should do a triathlon. And I said, no way, I'd never do that. And the next thing I knew, I found myself biking with friends in the snow for 100 miles or something. And I loved it. And it all went downhill from there. So if everything works correctly, the show title will gradually be changed over time to Zen and the Art of Endurance. And yeah, another reason I want to do it is because so much of going long has to do with nutrition. In triathlon, like doing an Ironman or an Ultraman, has to do with nutrition and pacing and smart training, which is something that directly applies to the other sports, like ultra marathons and ultra distance gravel racing. I mean, the Unbound has a Unbound XL, a 350-mile race, and we want them to tune in to this show and learn about how to put down 350-plus calories per hour like I did on today's bike ride. And how to balance training with fun and work. Oh, and of course, mixing in a little bit of Eastern philosophy along the way. There's a moment of Zen after the interview, actually, when I'm leaving the pool. Okay, enough of that. Let's go ahead and join Chase as he calls in from Phoenix. And let's get in his mind about how and why he does what he does to be so fast. Here is Chase Wark, part one. Let's go. All right, we are here with the incredible Chase Wark. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing really good. We ran into each other. You don't know this, but I spotted you at the Valley of Tears pre-race meet.
Okay.
And
yeah.
You and I were actually standing almost next to each other. I don't know. Most people in gravel are kind of like maybe in their 30s and maybe 40s and something like that. And I saw you standing next to me and you really stood out because you're a little bit younger. And then you had this look on your face of intensity, of you're paying so close attention with intensity to what they were saying that I knew that like you were wanting to like, in my mind, like soak up every single detail in case there was something, you know, that they were going to say that was, you know, really important.
I like to find the rules and like get as close to them as I can with like breaking them, but not breaking them. So I was listening for, could you have a feed like anywhere out on course?
Me too.
And then I think it was in like the pre-race email or rules, but I've always wanted to like find a loophole where you can take support anywhere on the course and you can like swap bikes and you know, there was a good amount of pave.
Have you been to a race where they've allowed you to swap bikes? I don't think I've seen that.
I don't know. I'd have to go back and like look in the rules. A lot of the Minnesota races, they just like only let you take support at aid stations or no support. So,
right.
Yeah. And then all these big ones, yeah, usually just only take support at the aid stations. So from like one aid station to another, it'd have to be all pavement. Like if I wanted to switch to a road bike. So,
they definitely, gravel's definitely the Wild West of it. Reminds me of triathlon. Before I even got into triathlon, before Ironman took over such a big brand, there was no standards. And I think that's why Ironman became so successful, is they standardized stuff. And then when you go to different races, then you know which the setup is, you know, and then you can compare races better and compare performances better against each other and stuff. And yeah, I was listening for same thing on the aid stations. Like they kind of said that you could hand up, or maybe they didn't at the different aid stations, but they just recommended that you just do this one or two aid stations for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I also usually skip the rider meetings. So I didn't know it was going to happen then. So once it started, I was hoping to make an exit, but then I looked back and the room was just filled with people. So I'm like,
yeah,
well, I guess I'm stuck here for the rider meeting. So,
But Emily Newsom missed that and didn't know about the map course change, you know, like the day before the race. And then I assume she didn't go to the pre-race meeting because she didn't know. She didn't have the latest GPS thing. And that was brought up a lot, you know? So,
yeah.
So you're in Phoenix right now. How did you end up in Phoenix? Aren't you from Wisconsin? What are you doing?
So I'm from, I guess I can tell how I got into Phoenix. My wife and I, we're in a small town called Winona, Minnesota. So it looks like Wisconsin. It's on the border between Minnesota and Wisconsin. And
right.
It kind of almost has Wisconsin vibes in the town, as in like a good amount of bars. Mm-hmm. But my wife doesn't like the cold weather of Minnesota. So, and I race full time now. So when she brought up the idea of doing travel nursing, I didn't say no to it. And I like to kind of live by like the motto of like, you only live once. So like YOLO, I guess. But so it's like, you know, there's no other time we'll get to snowbird down to Phoenix or.
Yeah.
So then there was like two conditions, though. It was we had to live close to a gym with a sauna because I use the sauna almost after every single ride. Mm-hmm. And then it had to be in a good training area. So we're in like northeast Scottsdale.
Oh, yeah.
So like if you know where McDowell Park is at.
Yeah.
We're definitely like right on the edge of that.
I love that park. We've done Cactus Cup twice now out there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that park is amazing. It's so awesome. Yeah.
So close to a lot of hiking trails for my wife. And
yeah,
I guess I'm close to like one good road training route, which actually I'm like sick of it now. I'm excited to go back to Winona, and like where I live is called the Driftless region, and there's just an endless amount of loops, and
Yeah.
I feel like I've roads like 30 to 40 miles away. I still need to explore a whole bunch. So
Are you
yeah.
near, have you heard of New Ulm, Minnesota?
Yeah, there's a good root beer made there,
My
1919 root beer.
great great grandparents pretty much founded that town and
Whoa.
owned the hardware store in the middle of town. They were the wealthy family that was the center of town.
Okay,
And
dang.
on Sundays they would cook food. It was all German. My great grandmother was
Yep.
there, and she didn't speak English until she was 16, even though she was born there. And they
Whoa.
on Sundays they would all cook breakfast or cook a meal on Sundays to give to the rest of the town in the basement of their house. Yeah, and they owned the hardware store, which was like that's like owning Sears or something, you know, in a town.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. That's awesome, man. Yeah, and then they moved down to Tennessee and then Texas. So,
Okay, just kept going south, more and
yeah,
more south.
getting out of that heat. Yeah, my wife's a nurse.
Yeah.
Or getting out of the cold. My wife's a nurse too. She's not a traveling nurse though, but she keeps bringing it up.
Yeah.
Wants to do
Yeah,
it.
it's a good gig.
Yeah. So how did you get into endurance cycling, gravel racing, and such?
Yeah, so how I got into biking was my grandma and I used to bike to the Dairy Queen pretty often, like when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and same with my parents. And then we ended up moving. We lived like 3 miles out of town, and then we moved 10 miles out of town. So the Dairy Queen rides kind of stopped. But then I lived on this block that was, I say block, but it's like a 5 mile square, and I would bike with my grandma around that. And then from there, when I was in, it was like when I was 14 and 15, I had a bike to hockey practice with one of my friends. And so we had a bike 10 miles each way. And I just always tried pushing myself to go faster and faster. And one day there was, I Googled how fast like bike racers go. And I don't know, there was like a chart that said like beginners go 20 miles per hour. So one day on a crazy tailwind, on like my Trek, just beginner mountain bike, I averaged 20. I dropped my friend. I didn't even tell him what I was doing. I just went for it. And yeah, I from there, I'm like, I'm fast. So then I got a road bike, and then it was easier to go faster. And yeah, then signed up. Well, I did a mountain bike race. That went really bad. But yeah, then got into road biking for, I was 16 when I did my first race, or 15. And then from there, raced in college at the U of M. And then Minnesota, actually the gravel scene, a lot of the early like gravel races were actually in Minnesota. So my first gravel race was in 2018, I believe, called Lakeville, Middletown Lakeville, free gravel race, kind of like how a lot of them used to be. And yeah, I did it on a cross bike with 33 millimeter tires, and that was super standard back then. And yeah, then I realized like I suck at sprinting on the road, so I'm like, okay, I'll never do well in crits, even though I love crits and just like the chaos of them. I could never win one. And then with like the road scene, it's essentially dead in the Midwest. So I yeah did then 2020, so the pandemic happened, and one of like the only races was called the Day Across Minnesota, or the Dam, which is like this super popular race in Minnesota, but I feel like no one else has heard of it. So you bike point to point across Minnesota on gravel roads, and I did that on a specialized Venge with 32 millimeter tires, and I ended up winning. And I realized from like that day on that just long, brutal days on the bike suited me. So yeah, then 2021, still a lot of the road scene wasn't coming back in the Midwest. So a lot, I did mostly gravel. And yeah, from there did the Dam. And then in 2021, I won that the next week, and I did Gravel Worlds, and I got third. And that's when I got picked up by the Mazda Lauf team, or the Mazda Orange Seal team is now what they're called. But they offered me a spot on the team right at the award ceremony. So,
so yeah, how does it happen? Does somebody like walk up to you, put their hand on your shoulder, and they're like, "Hey, come over here. We want to talk behind this tent or something like that."
No, it was like some gravel races. They have all the age group awards. So the gravel world's podium ceremony is over an hour long. So you kind of get bored or find people to talk to. But yeah, Jonathan Kavner, he was one of the co-founders of the team. He walked up to me and was like, "Hey, good job today. Like, do you have a team for next year? We'd love to have you. Here's what the team can offer to help you."
Yeah.
And then it was like, "Can I get your number?" And he, but I, yeah, I don't think he could have, should have offered me a spot on the team right there. And I think maybe a little while afterwards, he like was like, but then yeah, him and John Harp, the like director of the team, I hopped on a call with those two guys later. And yeah.
Yeah. I think there's, I've seen it a lot where people go long distance, like they've got a background, like collegiate racing, whatever sport, but they never were the best because most sports are short, you know?
Yeah.
And, but they've got a, what you're looking for, if I was to look for a long distance athlete, I would look for somebody with a good history in the sport, like what exactly what you said, growing up doing it. And, but somebody that wasn't the fastest, because that's a sign that actually they've probably a little bit more slow twitch than fast twitch. The fast people, the winners at the fast stuff need to stay at the fast stuff.
Yeah, I feel like it's pretty easy. Like, I think gravel, you know, talent gets you a little ways in gravel, but it really comes down to like hard work. Whereas, especially crits, like I know people who are just naturally gifted with a really good sprint. And as long as you can make that, like, you know, group of 10 sprinters in the front, like, that's kind of it. Where, gravel racing, you can't, you know, I know people who are winning national level crits with 10 hours of training, but
Because they're
anyone exploding. Anyone who's doing a winning a gravel race, they're putting in 30 hours at like their not their shortest, but pretty so, big hours.
Just got picked up by Lifetime, right? Is that still going on? Is this a real thing?
Yeah.
I need to say this now. You know, you and I, we became friends before you became picked up by Lifetime, you know?
Yeah, I think so when you reached out.
I reached out to you before that was even a thing. So I saw it too. I was like, because of what you're riding on your bike and your bike setup specifically, I was like, this guy knows what he's doing and this is going to pay off. And this is one of the reasons you're so fast is you're doing something that most people aren't doing. And it's something I catch crap for doing as aero as I can. And I'm, but also I tell people, dude, it's actually pretty easy. And if you're not doing it, you're just giving up free speed. And I have conversations with people about all the time that are like, why do you have aero bars on your gravel bike? Or why do you try to aero out your bike or your wheels and stuff like that? And I'm like, because after riding a time trial bike, as much as I have, I've ridden a time trial bike for 15, 20 years, you know, and sitting upright on a road bike is, or at any position on a road bike without just a round tube road bike or whatever, and not optimizing it, you feel so slow. Like there's so much more speed to have. But do you know who dropped out of Lifetime so that you got that spot, or did they? How did they reach out to you?
Yeah. So I don't know. Like, I would say I'm 99% sure I got. Well, I guess he's not on the roster anymore. I got Connie Losers or Losers spot. He's a Swiss rider. I think he got 10th overall last year. So I don't know why he dropped out, but yeah, it was the Thursday before Mid-South and I was standing in a subway line, like subway sandwiches.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I get a phone call and I'm like, oh, like sometimes I'll get random phone calls because my phone number is out there for my bike events I put on.
Yeah.
And people will like ask questions. I'm like, okay, it must just be some random person like wanting to know is the course marked or whatever. But then I answer, I'm like, hello. And she's like, hi, this is Rebecca from Lifetime. And like right when she said Lifetime, I'm like, no way. Like, I think I know what's about to happen. And she's like, someone dropped out, would you be would and like you're next in line? Would She didn't say next in line, but yeah, she was like, would you want to be a part of it? And then I was like, heck yeah, like, and I thought I was gonna cry because I was like super happy, but I didn't. But I did step outside of Subway to like call my mom and text my wife. So yeah.
Is your grandmother still around? Are you able to tell her?
Yeah, I called her later that day. Yeah.
That's awesome, dude. It sounds like
So
there's a lot of the reason you're doing this. She'd be so proud.
oh, different. I have like, oh, the grandma that got me into biking, she's older. I don't like, she doesn't have a cell phone, so I actually don't text her. But I have three,
Writer
I'm
letter.
pretty lucky. I have three grandmas. I got like,
Oh,
and they're
okay.
all super supportive in different ways. So one, I talk to two more often, and yeah, I let them know. So.
That's a big deal. My grandparents were super supportive of everything, and that they passed that down to my parents too. We all inherit that. It's a family chain
Yeah.
of why are you driving a car to the gas station, to go get something from the corner store? Like, ride your bike, or
Yeah.
walk. Oh, and we always lived close enough to school where I could bike to school or walk to
Okay.
school. All on purpose. So then when my son grew up, on purpose, we live in a neighborhood where there's an elementary school and a middle school and a high school all nearby so that he could bike. And then now he's biking and racing,
Done.
so you didn't know that you were like an alternate, right? They didn't tell you.
Yeah, they weren't like, oh, because Truman Glasgow was like the first person who got like called up and took someone's spot. And yeah, they didn't like reach out after that. And they're like, oh yeah, you're next in line. And I didn't ask them. I don't know if they went off of like my last year's application or if they took into consideration my results from earlier in the year. So I won Rock Cobbler and then the second place at Valley of Tears and then 14th at BWR Arizona.
I pay reasonably close attention to gravel racing just because it's so much fun. And yeah, you've popped up a bunch at towards the top of races. So the fact that you weren't already on it, I mean, it just shows how competitive it is and how we've got people from Europe and stuff like that in it. Because as
Oh,
far as an
yeah.
American on the American scene, like you're definitely and like how you popped up on my radar was when Ben Delaney did a video of your bike, I think last year, maybe at Gravel
Yeah.
Worlds.
Yep.
And
Yeah. Grab the Nebraska Gravel Worlds.
I took a screenshot of your bike from that video and I sent it to people to make them mad. I'm like this, or also to get them excited to my triathlete friends, because some of them have running injuries or something like that and they can't do triathlon or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, dude, gravel is the new triathlon. And they're like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, it's all about the bikes are changing so fast. It's like in the 2000s, in the 90s, and the early 2000s when the bike technology was changing so fast for time trial bikes. It made it so cool and so fun. And everybody was getting into Ironman to try to figure out how to do an Ironman as fast as possible. And so
Yeah.
the fact that it was like undiscovered country and people were trying to do crazy things and see what worked is exactly what, and also push the rules and see what's like, like how are we allowed to do this sport? And then and the sport was changing so fast, it made it really interesting. And I feel like that's exactly what's going on with gravel. Triathlon had been around forever, and then all of a sudden it just blew up. And then, but that's going on with gravel. Gravel's been around forever, but then I think a confluence of events where mountain bike technology made it possible to make road bikes way more capable on gravel. The geometry of a gravel bike, they figured out, how to like kick the fork out, shorten the stem, then you won't go over the front end of the bars. And then they figured out disc brakes, which allowed you to get wider tires and a wider frame. And then tubeless tires with sealant from mountain biking allowed you to get not get flats. You could ride forever and not get a flat,
Yeah.
out in gravel. And then the next thing and you've got, and then the, yeah, pushing the seat forward a little bit, getting over the bars. And the next thing you know, you've got gravel bikes that are like super capable road bikes. And
Oh,
then
yeah.
people not being excited about riding on open road and getting hit by cars. When on gravel, there's hardly, if there is a car, you can hear it coming from a mile away.
Yeah.
And then you can ride with friends, and it's like, this is amazing. Like, this is so cool. And then there's all the, you don't have to shut down. That's the other one. You don't have to shut down roads, although we should, do better at closing intersections. But I think that's common. You can put on a race almost anywhere, where, because the problem with putting on a triathlon or like a bike race of any kind is you have to close down all this traffic. It costs a ton of money to close down all these roads in a city or around that area. And in gravel, the further away from everything, the more people like it.
I've put on cyclocross races, road races, crits and time trials, and now gravel events. And by far, I guess the cyclocross stuff was pretty easy because it was in my parents' backyard, except we had to do a whole bunch of like yard maintenance, but and just mowing field. But yeah, like for a gravel event, it's so easy. Just like for me, I go county to county and ask like, hey, can I have a bike ride on these roads? And they're like, yeah, as long as people like follow the rules of the road. And yeah, I from my side, like I'm a big believer in like keeping gravel affordable and pretty grassroots. So like the closer, like there becomes so much additional cost usually with counties if you have to like control intersections and maybe not like in Emporia or like way out in the sticks, but a lot of the gravel races are only like an hour out of bigger cities. So it's like, yeah, that there would be an additional cost, and I'd rather charge $50 for a gravel event than $100. And I think it only affects mostly the front people racing, where a lot of the folks are just out there trying to have a good time and achieve their goal. So like stopping at a stop sign wouldn't make or break their event.
The North American road bike scene just seems to be dying off temporarily. It'll always come back and stuff, but we don't have like a big American. Well, we have Sep Kuss.
Oh, I think the US pros are really good right now. We got Sepp, Mateo just won, Perry Neese,
You're right.
Nielsen Paulus. We got like Sean Quinn. Who else? Magnus Sheffield. Like, yeah, there's a good American, I feel like, almost on every team nowadays. But yeah, Sepp would be like our grand tour hope, which I guess is what most people actually end up watching for bike races.
Well, let's talk about the bike that you're riding right now, because this is, let's talk about this bike, because Gravel Worlds, I think, is when I first saw your bike, really stood out because of the head disc wheel, which was invented primarily for triathlon, because at Ironman World Championships in Kona, it's so windy there, they don't allow a rear disc. So Head decided to break the rules or work around the rules and create this almost disc. It's got the tiniest hole in the middle of it. So it looks like a rear disc. But another thing is, I tease my son because I've got a wheel cover, which is a really cheap and easy way to put a disc on. I've got a zip rear wheel, an 808, but to fill it out completely, I put a wheel cover on it, during triathlons and Ironmans and stuff. And John Tomac was putting a wheel cover, or it was a solid carbon rear wheel when he used to mountain bike race off road. So it's a thing. It's been a thing forever, and there's no rule against it. And your bike looked like, seriously, like kind of looks like a triathlon bike, like a time trial bike from the side with that disc. And I was just like, wow, that thing is so cool. And then I don't think at that point I paid attention to the brand. I may have noticed it was a Lauf, may have not. But then over the past year or so, as I've realized more and more that the thing that's holding so much of us back is tire clearance, so that we can put bigger tires in. And I paid more and more attention to what is, like a bike. So for my next gravel bike, I want to get one with really wide tire clearance. And also for my son's racing too, And that way you can ride big or you can ride medium still. And then on a muddy, unbound course, you could still have plenty of tire clearance, so you're not gonna, jam up the tires and still have some decent tires in there. And Lauf, which is out of Iceland, meets that. They're one of the biggest clearance. I think it's 57 millimeter, like a 2.2 inch mountain bike tire, like a 29 inch wheel, 2.2 inch mountain bike tire. But you don't have to do that. And then people that know stuff about aerodynamics and wind tunnel and track racing and stuff like that know about the Hope bike and these other bikes where they have really wide tire clearance on purpose, because there's a thought that instead of having really tight tire clearance, right? To slice through the wind as narrow as possible. It's just as debatable to have wide tire clearance, and that allows the air to pass through the fork and the seat stays more easily and not jam it in there. So you could go either way and they can't really decide which way is faster. So a gravel bike that has wide tire clearance by nature might be just as fast as one with narrow tire clearance anyway. And then you have the choice of having wider tires if you want them. Like when we did Valley of Tears, that rails to trail part was rough.
Oh, yeah.
That thing was so rough. And I was like, I can run a 47 on my front, but I can only run a 42 on the rear. So I do. And I could just tell the 47 was just so much better than the 42 on the rear. And I was glad I had that. And I have a suspension stem, right, to eat up the bumps as much as possible. And my old gravel bike actually has a suspension fork on it. It was a cheap suspension fork. It was an old bike that I had a suspension fork on. And that thing was so smooth over rough stuff. And, you know, cheap, poor man's suspension is fat tires, right? The fatter the tire and lower tire pressure. And so how did you end up with Lauf? Or did they come with the team, or like did Lauf reach out to you independently?
Yeah, so Lauf came with the team. So I was with the team for 2 years. And during those 2 years, Lauf, for like the first half of the first year, we were on their True Grit, which had the Lauf suspension fork. But the bike didn't have as much tire clearance. And then I think the last bike I did on the True Grit was Onbound.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had my Segla, but it was in Winona by the time, like, and I was already in Emporia, so I wasn't able to ride it. And then, so 2 years with the team on Lauf, and then around Gravel Worlds last year. So Lauf is a sponsor of Gravel Worlds. I started thinking of doing my own privateer program just to separate from the team and start working on, like, it's easier for me to have my own privateer program and then have those same sponsors sponsor my events and my coaching company instead of having like different sponsors for those. So I talked with them at Gravel Worlds, we signed. They were like the first people to say, oh yeah, we'd love to support you, and like you've been crushing it last or in 2023. So the more I've ridden the Segla, the more I've just like fallen in love with the tire clearance, honestly. Like, some people will be like, oh yeah, my bike can fit 50 millimeter tires or whatever, but then there's no, you know, a little flex in the tire or wheel and it's rubbing the frame, where like I put 2.2s on and there's almost a finger width of clearance around the whole entire frame. So there's, and even with the fork, when it dampens or like compresses, it doesn't rub the frame. So there's just so much clearance. And then it's also come in handy at Onbound when the mud section in the beginning, I made it out with the front group. So I was with Keegan and like Russell and Howie, and like I'm this like small name with all the biggest names in gravel racing, and I flat it out of the group. But and then 2 months later I'm in Gravel Worlds and I'm with like John Borstelman, Brendan Wirtz, Steven Vogel, all these guys with FTPs over 400 watts, Steven and Brendan close to 500, and I'm like, I don't know how long I'll be able to last with them because this terrain suits them. But then we hit a mud section and Brennan drops anchor because his bike doesn't have any clearance. And there's a Dutch guy who had zero clearance. And like all of a sudden this group of, and Freddie Ovette, who trains with Remco Evenepoel and Matthew Vanderpool, like some big hitters, they all just drop because their bikes couldn't clear the mud. And like, all of a sudden it's me, John Borstelman, and Steven Vogel pop out of it. And I'm like, okay, well, I guess if I just draft off of these guys, I have the podium at least. And then Steven ran out of gas. And then it was just me and John hanging out the rest of the day. So,
And okay, so I think people that, you know, follow my show mostly for triathlon and some for gravel, or not don't know much about gravel. The tire clearance thing and the tire size is the leading edge of like the sport right now. And it seems to be, but the aero bars is one thing, should you or should you not ride aero bars? But the thing, the low-hanging fruit that I think so many people don't understand is the tires. And we're giving away the game right here, but like when you ride with wider tires, then you can ride lower tire pressure and they're supple. And then it would be like with gravel being rough and then some other stuff, which I want to mention in a second, like mud. But then another one I'm going to mention in another second is it's like you're riding against somebody. If you have wider tires, it's like they're riding wooden wheels. Somebody else that has narrower tires is bouncing around all over the place. It's uncomfortable. And if your tires are wider, then there's more supple and they roll over stuff better and you have more control. And seriously, like with gravel races, you don't know what you're going to get on race day, right? It could be fine or it could be muddy, right? And then you've only got one bike unless you're really well off and got some kind of team that's giving you like multiple different bikes. I just don't know that that's even a thing. So you really have like one bike for the season. Or you go with a sponsor and they got one bike. So go with the sponsor with the widest tire clearance as possible. And another big one is sand. You have wide tires. Go ride your road bike with 23 millimeter tires down the beach, and then go ride a mountain bike down the beach. And one of them you can ride on a beach, and the other one you can't. And what happened at Valley of Tears is you guys were in the front and y'all hit that big patch of sand. And I've seen video footage of Justin McQuarrie. He has it. Several people have it on video footage where somebody like number three or number four in the group had a narrow enough tire where it got sideways in the sand and it caused this huge pile up. And then you two guys, was it just you two that
No,
took?
there was a group of six of us
Oh, but
originally.
you're tiny, just disappeared over the horizon, just gone. Like you could barely see you guys, just gone. And because y'all either are cyclocross experts, which you actually are too, and can ride in sand and know how to control a bike in sand, but also with wider tires, you can actually float on sand a whole lot better. When I used to ride with my son, when we first got gravel bike or first started doing gravel bikes, I was riding maybe like a 40 or a 38, and he was too, but he weighs like 50 pounds less than I do at that time. And I would just sink in the sand. And he's like, come on, dad, let's go. And I'm like, I can't. I'm just stuck. Like every time I'd fall over because the bike just comes to a stop. Like it's, like run aground, like a boat run aground. But your weight, you can do a narrower tire if you don't weigh anything, because then you float better over the sand. But once you start loading up with a camel bag full of water and bottles and all that, you start weighing the bike down with all this stuff. Yeah, so I think that you and Dylan Johnson talks a lot about it, are trying to, there's so much low-hanging fruit of things to optimize for gravel, that because gravel is so traditional, this whole spirit of gravel thing, or what the big running joke now, what is the spirit of gravel? It's mountain biking. That you guys are figuring out that wider tires is like the biggest thing that's holding people back, like not, or having tires that are too narrow. I also think mechanicals, where people have they're relying a little bit too much on luck that something's not going to go wrong. And in a really long race that's off-roadish, out in the boonies, that you the person that's the most prepared for like all eventualities is actually going to do better too.
Yeah, you want reliable, fast, wide tires,
Yeah.
essentially. And like, you can't just pick any wide tire. Also, I don't know if, there's a website out there that tells you the fastest mountain bike tires. So, and that's where Dylan and I think Dylan gets his information from there. 'Cause
Yeah.
I know the two tire.
Rollingresistance.com.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we both, you can look at the top two mountain bike tires, and it's what I've ran and what Dylan has run. So, and I think one is more reliable than the other. But
So
I think, I mean, my tentative plan for Onbound is running 2.2 mountain bike tires, just because we're headed north this year and it's chunky gravel. And the chunkier the gravel gets, the more important that the wider tires are, and the less important, you could say aerodynamics of a narrower tire becomes, because the speed's gonna be slower and we're just gonna be getting thrown around on chunky flint rock.
Right. Yeah, and a mountain bike tire will handle that rock a whole lot better.
Yeah.
Dude, when I go mountain biking, I don't really pay attention to what's going to slash my tires or not so much because mountain bike tires are so tough. Well, just because they're so much bigger, they're going to not puncture in it as easily. And then, are you going to ride? Okay, so Lauf, for people that don't know, has that innovative mount suspension fork. That's actually what they made first, right? It was the suspension fork, and then they came out with this frame. And oh, the other thing about Lauf is they're actually not that expensive.
Yeah, they're like ha over less than
Yeah.
like my bike that I use. Okay, take the Jet 180 off of it.
Yeah.
Like, if you go to Lauf, you can get a bike with a mullet setup, which is SRAM Eagle transmission in the back, and then SRAM Force cranks and like levers and brakes, which, you know, even like for me, I'm a professional and I don't run SRAM Red. But like, and yeah, like it's $4,800. And if you tried building that exact same setup on Specialized or Trek,
That's 8,000, 9,000,
it's yeah,
10,000.
it's gonna be eight, nine,
Yeah.
$10,000. Yeah. And
And
like,
their fork is like a $300 upgrade, the suspension fork, right?
yeah.
$300 maybe. And then you got a
Yeah.
suspension fork on the front of that thing. So tell us a little bit. Are you thinking about running the suspension fork at Unbound?
Yeah, I'm for sure running the suspension fork. Last year I didn't run it because I was like, okay, like as a pro, like I would suggest the suspension fork to anyone unless you're trying to hang on to Keegan's wheel on an uphill and you need to save every single gram. So I didn't run it and I regret that because I just got beat up by the end of the day. And if I have the fork, like my hands feel way better, my back feels way better. And just over, you know, Unbound is 10 hours, it all adds up. So,
That fork is so fascinating because it's really lightweight for a suspension fork. It's very lightweight. And then it's got people go check it out. It's the Lauf LAUF fork. And when they first came out with that, it's got a kind of like a floating axle behind the rake of the front of the fork. And then the people think that's carbon fiber leaf springs, but it's not. They're like glass fiber reinforced poly whatever glass fiber. But like there's this video of GCN where they're hitting it with hammers and stuff, and it's super tough. And yeah, you got to decide because you can't lock it out. You got to decide. Yeah, when you're climbing uphill, it's going to be a little bouncy, but it's only like 3 centimeters of travel. It's not much. But then
Yeah.
it puts the travel in the best spot. It floats the front of the frame. I think gravel racing is exactly. I did a long gravel ride one time on my mount a hardtail mountain bike with a lockout front suspension fork on it. Long time. That was my very first long gravel ride. And that was amazing. And I used to actually race on that mountain bike too. And it had a lockout, on the handlebar. And having lots of plush suspension when you want it is so cool. And then being able to firm it up on the road, or when you want to go uphill. I timed it. I used to do this laps around the local bike park and timed it. And it really made a difference. So how'd you get into this head wheel package? Did you buy it first? Or did they offer it to you or what?
Yeah, so being from Minnesota,
Oh yeah, okay,
yeah, Head ended up sponsoring the gravel team in 2023. Both we had Eno, my teammate, he's also from Minnesota, so we've known Ann from Head for years and years, and the idea came up, I want to say Big Sugar 2023. I think they had a concept wheel actually.
Right.
And then I knew about it and I asked if I could run it at Gravel Worlds or if they could make me a wheel for Gravel Worlds. 3 days before I did para nationals on a tandem as a pilot, and I knew that I'd be pretty like gassed for or like tired from the racing in Georgia and then having to fly over to Nebraska. So yeah, I did it kind of as a media stunt originally, and then I ended up getting second at Gravel Worlds and just comparing my power to John's, and like yeah, I think it is a faster wheel. So yeah, so I got it. They just gave it to me hoping for some media attention and yeah, making the lead group of Gravel Worlds. It got a whole bunch of attention. So it was mission accomplished there. And yeah, they let me keep it. So now it's, I run it on any course that's flat or rolling hills. So
do you think they make a gravel? Do they make a gravel 180? Let's see.
Oh, so this is custom made. Yeah. So it is. So it's they don't make it online. For me, they took their gravel Emporia rim, which is 26 millimeter internal and then 31 millimeter external. And because that the Jet 180, that's just a fairing, it's not structural. They were just able to put that onto the Emporia rim.
Yeah, they kind of bowed it out at the rim, I guess.
If you look at it, it actually, it's weird. It gets stuck in at some points. So it's not a completely smooth disc, but, and then if you run too narrow of a tire, it will make like a clicking sound because of the pressure on the fairing. So, but yeah, they don't sell them online. I don't know if
it's an Emporia rim, right? So it's like but with the head 180 fairing on. So it's a, and what did you say were the dimensions on the Emporia rim? What's the internal width?
26 millimeters.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's plenty. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Cool. Because I was going to ask you, like, how do you run this wheel and then have enough width for a good, decent gravel tire? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes more sense. For people that want to know, oh my gosh, that wheel's expensive. You're lucky, dude. They got this wheel. And one of a kind. That thing might end up in a museum someday.
Yeah, I've done... So... In 2021, I actually, when I did the day across Minnesota, they gave me a full disc wheel with bird spokes inside, and I ran that at a gravel race. So, like, actually, me running a disc wheel at gravel races, I should have ran it at Gravel Worlds in 2021. I had it with me, but I ended up not doing that, and I kind of regret it. But yeah, I've been like always interested in like what's the fastest bike setup for years now. So
yeah, and like you said, you've been able to compare power numbers with other people.
Not Keegan; he keeps his power private. So yeah. I wanted to look at my power compared to his power at Valley of Tears because, like, I don't know. So I ended up crashing and breaking my Camelback and not having any carbs or anything to drink or eat for the last half of that race. But for the first half, like, sometimes I could hear him breathing pretty heavy, like on climbs. And I don't know if I had him on, like, if he just had to do a whole bunch of watts to like hang on to me. And then if he had to pull through at that exact, or like, if, you know, I was doing roughly like 300 watts when I would pull through. I don't know if he had to do 350, 400 or 400 watts.
Yeah.
And just like, yeah.
Yeah, so when I was doing that race, I ended up with a group of people that were a fast group that was doing the 77 miler or whatever it was. And I was on aero bars. So basically I have my bike rigged out with a forward facing seat post and triathlon bars, you know, aero bars and such. And I was able to pass this pace line and keep up with them easily. Because of the position I was in, and they're all riding upright like a bunch of roadies. And I would just I would rotate off the front, like very easily keep up with them, you know? And I was like, man, this is crazy that more people don't do this. And then I've only seen a few photos of y'all racing together, but I just thought it was funny. It did not escape my notice that he was behind you in every photo that I saw drafting off of you.
That's just
I'm
me
saying that's what happened all the time.
Yeah,
but I'm just saying in the rare photos you were in front, and I'm like, yeah, because you're slicing through the wind, and he's trying to save energy. He's no dummy, man. He's like he's trying to you know, stay behind you. And then another funny thing that happened, I don't know if you know this. My son's girlfriend, my son was racing pro that day, and she and my wife were at the that aid station where y'all crashed, and they had it on video.
Yeah.
Kylie, my son's girlfriend, caught it on video. Yeah, the gravel was soft there, and your wheel got twisted as you went through some soft stuff, and you were probably trying to ride with one hand and like grab a Camelback, and
yeah.
then And yet, and Keegan was right on you, like behind you, probably trying to draft. And then he plowed into, I wouldn't say he plowed into you, but whatever. So like then he plowed into you, whatever. And then, yeah, your camelback, there was some kind of weird stuff going on with your camelback, and you were trying, all we saw in the videos, you were trying to still put it on and it wouldn't go on exactly. And you just took off. Right. And then after that happened, there was discussion amongst the group and they were like, we need to move to a different area and to like where it's harder soil, do hand ups, not in that soft gravel area. And so when the next pro wave came through, everybody had moved over because of y'all's crash. And after it was over, Kylie ended up talking to Sophia, and my wife ended up talking to Sophia. For people that don't know, that's Keegan's girlfriend who also won the women's division. She's world, I don't know if she's world champ. Is she world champ? But anyway, she's like the best in North America and an Olympian and all that stuff. And so like she was like, wait, send me that video. And then so they sent the video. So they're pouring over the video footage of how it actually, like how the crash went down, you know?
Yeah, I was
And
wondering.
yeah, I'll probably get around to sending it to you because I think you'd like to see it. And also it's proof that you didn't crash because you were in aero bars, you know, and you were riding on the hood. You know, I mean, you were riding, trying to stick your arm through a camelback, you know, riding upright. And so yeah, we've got that video, and it's pretty cool to see that. All right, gang, we are going to have to leave off with this interview right now and just do the first half in this podcast. We go on for 2 hours about even more stuff. Oh, it is such a great interview, and I don't want to dominate an entire show and make you miss any of it because you're like, oh, I'm gonna listen to something else, because nowadays we only have the attention span for like an hour. It is worth it. So I'm gonna put the second half in the next episode. We cover so much more stuff. And let's jump back to what I'm doing here. We are leaving the pool. This is day two of 3 days of swimming back to back. And I actually recorded yesterday after leaving the pool, predicting that today would be hard. And I was right. I had to really scale it back today. And oh man, I'm a little sore. But I think it's gonna all be okay. Here's my giant IKEA bag. Try to get this all organized here. And also, I'm gonna keep this one a little bit short right here because we've got endurance sports news that's so cool. With the Barkley Marathons, the first woman, and more stuff. So today's swim is a really good example of how to modify workouts when you're tired and just went by time instead of by distance. And it works out to be about the same amount of time. So if I feel good, then I can tell by the warm-up. I use the form goggles and they'll tell me by the end of my warm-up what my pace was, well, during the entire thing. So I usually swim 850 yards and I know my pace for that to feel good. Let's just move this whole thing in. And then if I'm slow and I'm sore, then I cut it back. I don't even do the full 850. I can already tell, you know. So I just do the 800. And so instead of doing five sets of 850, I do five sets of 800. And the fact that I'm cutting it short by 50 yards every set already feels like it's easier and it feels relaxing and chill. And then that slower pace actually ends up being the same amount of time. And while I was swimming, I was sitting there thinking, okay, what do I need to do to be able to swim faster tomorrow? Because that's usually my mindset. What do I do to be able to swim faster next time? The Sammy Inkinen method. And I was like, dude, you need to figure out what to do, not just to swim faster. Bye. Thank you.
Do
I?
You're welcome to come to the gate over here if you'd like.
Really?
To not go through the turnstile.
Every day?
Yes.
How long has this been going on? Has this been a thing for a while?
This has been a thing for a while.
Life never ceases to amaze.
You don't have to fight through the turnstile.
I think if I was real little, it would be a problem. That was funny. Leaving the pool. It's freezing cold. I always have to fight through this turnstile door, and then I just drop something. You probably heard it. Only to find out that I could use the other door and just pull on it from the other side. Like the Far Side, where it's got the school for the gifted or whatever, and he's pushing on the pool door. Anyway, there's your moment of zen right there. Always improving, always learning. What you think is reality may not be. Not only does it depend on perspective, that's cliche, but it may not even be what you think it is. All right. Got to talk a little bit about the swim and then about Jasmine, Princess Jasmine. And the Barkley Marathons. Holy crap. I'm just so impressed. I've been following that race for so long. All right. Pool was closed on Monday due to lightning. So I went ahead and swam on today, which is Tuesday. I biked Monday morning instead. I didn't work out at all over the weekend supporting Kai's race. Had a couple beers, which was fun. But let's see. So I started biking again yesterday morning, and you know, nice ride. Oh, power was up. Everything's nice. And then today noticed while swimming that I was cramping a little bit, which is really weird. Usually that's a sign of doing too much, but I didn't do anywhere near as much. So I'll have to put that one in the memory banks, is like in the WTF bank. All right. And how much gas do I got? I got barely. I got 16 miles of gas. Work is 4 miles away. I can do it. And my struggle that I'm going to have to contemplate is I swim hard enough that it takes 48 hours to recover from. And then I swim Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And that ends up keeping me nice and stable. So what happens in the mind is you're used to swimming a certain effort. Well, with the pool being closed yesterday, so now I'm swimming Tuesday. This is Easter weekend coming up. And here in the Bible Belt, we've got, and in a lot of places around the world, I'm sure, we've got Good Friday coming up. And the pool is run by the government. And the pool will be closed on Friday. It's a city pool, so their city staff has the day off. And it is a... Hold on, I'm waiting for traffic. Got people on crosswalks. You know how when you cross a crosswalk and you pretend like you're not looking at cars? So they think that you're... They think that... So the driver thinks they might hit them. So then the driver slows down. That game we play. When really out of your peripheral vision, you know there's a car coming. You just don't make eye contact. Just had two of those. Anyway, I am sitting there going, man, I want to swim 3 times this week. But that ends up being Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. That's 3 days back to back. So how hard do you swim? How do you change your swim up so that it's sustainable to swim 3 days back to back? And it's not. Because I enjoy swimming as hard as I swim. I don't know how to hold back. And I'm like, you know, the mind is always like, well, it probably won't be that bad. I probably can handle it. No, I can totally predict that on Tuesday or Wednesday tomorrow, I'm going to be hurting because that's 2 days back to back. And then Wednesday, Thursday, I'll be hurting even worse. It takes like 4, 5, 6 days to, you know, like settle into a groove where the body learns how to be efficient at doing the back to back to back to back days. But it's okay. There's also a training style where you do a bunch days in a row and then take a few days off. And then a bunch days in a row and then take a few days off. More of a work and recover bigger peaks and valleys, and that works as well. Depends on what your life is like. The real key is to be flexible and to know that they both work, and do one when one applies and one when the other applies, the Zen approach, and not be attached to one way. Because then that creates misery. Like, I can only swim every other day. I can only swim Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Then you're in hell, as Zen would teach. Because you want a reality that's different than the one you're dealing with. And you've created your own hell. There's your moment of Zen. Bing bong. Okay. Jasmine, I believe her last name's Paris. And she's, funnily enough, from Scotland, I believe. Just became the first woman to finish the Barclay Marathon, which actually they call the Barclay Marathons because it's back-to-back. Just, it's supposed to be 100 miles. It is not 100 miles from what I understand. It is 110, 120, maybe 130 miles. And you know it is because of two reasons. One is the cutoff time is 60 hours, and that is really, really slow. And the other thing is hardly anybody finishes it in 60 hours. Only 20 people have ever finished the Barclay Marathons, and they've all been men. Maybe it's 19 people until now. She's the 20th, and she's the first woman. And the guy, I think his name's Laszlo, is a total psychopath, and he's great, though. And he makes the start time start at random times. You get like a 40-minute warning where they blow a horn, like a ram conch shell or something like that. And then, and it could be at 4 a.m., you know, you just don't know. It's anytime within the next like 12 hours or something. And that's part of it. And then the next thing is you do loops. I think it's 5 loops maybe, and it's in Frozen Head State Park in Middle Tennessee, East Tennessee, and I grew up in that area a bunch, and it is nightmarish terrain, which when you think about it, if she was training in the Scottish Highlands, if so, that's pretty good training territory. One guy sailed through it pretty well, and he actually lived across from the park a few years ago. He was a triathlete. It was pretty amazing. And he grew up in the park, so he was really familiar with it. But the whole thing is it's very disorienting. It's low mountains with fog and brambles and brush. You can't see jack. And I think they change up the course a little bit every time. And then as you go through, you have to grab pages from a book to prove. And then the book is named, you know, hideous things to mess with you, like For Whom the Bell Tolls and stuff. No Way Out. And usually people get bugled out. They play taps, I think, at lap three. A really good runner would make it to lap three. Really, really good runner would make it to lap three. So, and the whole thing got started because the guy that assassinated Martin Luther King escaped from a prison right next to the park. And then after 50 hours, he only went 10 miles or 12 miles. It was completely disoriented. And Laszlo lived in the area. And he's like, dude, this sounds like a great place to put a horrible run and make it. The whole point is to make it like Navy SEALs boot camp, where some years nobody graduates. And this is what that race is like, is some years nobody finishes. That's how you know it's just barely finishable. And asked over and over and over again, is he going to make it easier so that women can finish? And he said, no, I'm going to keep it exactly as it is. And I think that someday a woman will finish it. And it has finally happened. The day has come. She beat, and there's video footage. It is awesome. Google the Barclay Marathons and Jasmine, I think Paris, and watch the finish. She collapses as she touches the park gate bar. And with 99 seconds left. So it's a 60-hour cutoff. And she did it in 59 hours and 58 minutes. and a little bit of chain. There goes a woman running right there, right in front of me. And I always knew a woman could do it. I have a lot of faith that a majority of the reason that women aren't as fast as guys in sports is they don't have the depth of field. Like if you live in a small town, the fastest person really isn't all that fast, right? And if you live in a big city, like say football and stuff like that, then the best athlete is way better, basketball, because of the competition and the depth of field. Well, women's sports, women only really started being allowed to play men's sports, most sports, 50 years ago. And so they don't have the depth of field and the history and the school programs. I heard something just the other day that women's sports gets like 70 cents on the men's dollar for spending on their school programs for men's sports. Just my local high school that Kai went to, no swim team. All the money went to football. And then that's a boys' sport currently. And swim team would have been a women's sport NCAA college. And they could have gotten scholarships with that. But no. So it's little steps. Little steps. All right. Very inspirational. Congratulations, Jasmine. Did it following the exact same rules. What a badass story. And we will be right back. Bang. Hello. All right. Leaving the pool. Day three. 3 days in a row of 4,000 plus yards. And that hurt. That hurt a lot. I started off feeling kind of tight. And there's a thing in swimming and track where if you're a little bit tight, you actually go faster because the tension is tighter. And I thought, well, maybe I'll go faster because I had energy, you know. Oh, we're going to have the high schoolers next door gunning their engines. And and then I was about 150 yards in, and then it hurt. And I was like, oh. This is going to be another slow day, or just relax. And there's an upside and a downside to that. You know, downside is whatever, it hurts. But the upside is when you try to do stuff and it hurts. But let's back up and be clear on something. There, you learn that there is a difference between injury pain and just soreness pain. And once you distinguish between the difference, on a day when you have just soreness pain and you got energy, then that's a really good day to train durability. And what you do is you pay attention to your pace and you realize that you're actually making not bad, decent forward progress, even while it hurts. And then on, I got to take my goggles right here. I got to take them off the clip because I need to charge them. I need to plug them into my charger. I got to charge my goggles. These form goggles, man, I think about life before these things. These are fantastic. And it's my giant IKEA bag. I'm not going to need this jacket, so I'll throw this in the back here. Let it dry out. Where did I leave off? Oh, so you're on mile 35, 40 of a 50-mile trail run, and it hurts, you know. But then you're like, I can keep going. Because you know from before that you can. Because you've done it in practice. Minus rhabdo. If you take that out of the equation. Let's plug in these goggles. Well, we are in full chaos mode over at the high school. I got a message from somebody who said they love the post-swimming stuff. Because of the reality of what's going on. It's entertaining. Podcasting. Reality audio. Okay, that's all plugged in. Let's fire up fire engine one. And you can't get that kind of training unless you do, it doesn't have to be back to back, but relatively close workout days back to back. Like I mentioned probably at the beginning of the show, it's my plan to. I did 3 days of 11 miles in a row to train for Tahoe. And you know, by day three, I'd settled in. But, so I'm just swimming along, and The thing is when you're in pain, especially with swimming, probably cycling almost as much, you learn to go fast or keep up a decent pace. Well, you learn to be more efficient because if you're on swim team, because I was having flashbacks of swim team there briefly, all the way back to high school, where the coaches are yelling at you to keep the pace and you're in a lane where, you know, you're a certain pace and you have to, everything's by pace clock in swimming. And there's nothing you can do about it. You got to keep the pace, but you hurt. So you learn little tricks. You try little things. Your body figures out how to be fast, how to be more efficient, and where to put a little bit more glide in because you're trying to work around the pain. And so that it's useful there too. It really teaches you to, yeah, how to be more efficient and use less energy to go faster. And another thing was, man, it crossed my mind that I might have to get some sort of audio again while swimming. I used to use Swim P3 and stuff like that. But they were playing over the radio system that trend that I hope is dying. I think it's called shanty music or something, where it sounds like pirate songs. And it's just a trend, you know. But my God, dude, you're swimming in really cold water and cold day, and they're singing about, oh, yo, ho, in a bottle of rum, and somebody fell over the overboard, and now they're being whisked away into the darkness of the deep Davy Jones locker. It's like, I don't know if this is really good music to play along with swimming in the cold and in the dark, you know? Like, you start thinking about people trying to tread water, you know, while the Titanic's going down and over the horizon. It's not very motivational, is my point. And that and country music is the bane of my existence when working out, because country music's so sad. And disaster strikes constantly. Oh my gosh. And, you know, in Texas, that's what we got. And yeah, listen to the Marginal Gains podcast. Probably mentioned at the beginning of the show. That's really cool because John Cobb, I've met him. He doesn't remember me, but I remember him. And I can almost see the wind tunnel on my drive right here, the Texas A&M wind tunnel where it all got started. And let's go ahead and wrap up the show. I had a short conversation with Amrita Bars, one of our show fans, saw Kylie's girlfriend riding, a video I posted on Instagram, riding, wearing an Amrita shirt. It's kind of like a, kind of like a long sleeve loose jersey, more like a mountain bike jersey, just a long sleeve tech fabric shirt. And Amrita makes the coolest kit. And they said, hey, she's got an Amrita kit on. Where's Amrita as your sponsor? They used to be your sponsor. Man, I miss them. They were really, really good quality bars. They make date-based nutrition bars and other stuff. And I replied back and said, because they didn't tag Amrita in that post, and I name-dropped Amrita with a tag so they would see it, hopefully, and said, I don't know, where are they? It sure would be great. Maybe they'll see this. And they reached out to me and said, hey, let's start something up again. So we may have Amrita back on the show. We'll see how it works out, you know, because, you know, behind the scenes, sponsorships are really interesting. You know, they have what they want to do with their business, and it may not match up with what you want, right? And yeah, that's the business side of podcasting for those of you that enjoy that stuff. And every sponsorship ends up being different, and then they change over time. Some start off, I had the bike insurance company on just as pure money, but no, I used them for bike insurance briefly, and that's why but I don't think they gave me a discount. And when my Trek Speed concept was new and I was going to races and worried about, I was flying and I was worried about it being smashed or something like that. So we'll see about that. And Hannah Schell is a top female American cyclist. And she's a lot like Chase that we just had on, where she raced the Grand Prix, Lifetime Grand Prix last season. And then this season she's doing Cape Epic. She just finished Cape Epic And that is a 7-day stage race across South Africa. Or, I don't know, it's across South Africa. It's kind of like in South Africa near Stellenbosch area, which is awesome. A lot of triathletes actually come from there. And they did decently. It's a really difficult race. And so much of it is not up to you, you know. And because you have to race with a partner and you have to finish within, so many feet. Stones throw distance of your partner. If your partner has trouble, then the whole team slows down. So I forgot what place they got, but it's more of an experience and a lot of exposure, and it is an honor just to get there and to be able to race. It is considered probably the hardest mountain bike race in the world because of the competitiveness, and it is big deal. And they just did that, so we'll have them on the show, or her on the show, to talk about that pretty soon. Got to let her recover from that. And then, yeah, just think of 7-day stage race mountain biking. How fun would that be? And the scenery is unbelievable. But then also, Kai got his hands on a borrowed Cervelo, either S5 or R5, for his bike racing. I talked to him about what Mark said about crit racing. Got him way more into being, I think it's in the second part of the interview that we're going to play, but crit racing taught him how to be at the front of the pack in gravel racing, and how to move up from the back to the front of bike races at the start line and work your way up through the front and stay up front. It's really, really cool. If we didn't play it in the first part of the interview, it's in the second part. And I mentioned that to Kai, and Kai just did his first crit race. So, you know, put two and two together. We're like, oh man, this is the right thing for him to be doing. And he's swinging by today because he's off at college, but he's coming home today to go to a home, is it eye doctor appointment? Just get his eyes checked, you know, like a regular checkup. And with that, I'm wondering if he's bringing the road bike, and then I'm going to have to take the tri bike. If he's staying here for the weekend, then the tri bike is going to come off the trainer, because the only way I'm going to keep up with him on a road bike is on my tri bike, and that could be fun. We'll see. And have to reteach him how to road ride around here. It's been years since we did road riding around here, specifically, like what routes are really good, because we've been mixing in gravel so much. And ordered him some TPU tires, inner tubes, to upgrade probably what's in there. So, because he's going to be racing that bike, and it's rim brake. I call them caliper brakes for some reason. Rim brake, 10 speed, double chain ring, so 20 speed. But yeah, that's coming up next. And yeah, so next episode, look for more Chase part 2, Chase Wark. And also, don't forget, you can sponsor a show. You can be on the show as an advertiser and send me an email at texifornia@gmail.com. And we start off at $100 per episode, and we can get you on here and get your name out there. And then also with triathlon coaching, I do full triathlon coaching at $200 a month. $199. And I think that's it. So we got a lot of cool stuff coming up. All right, everybody stay safe out there. Work the uphills, cruise the downhills, and keep the rubber side down. Out.